Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people from Pakistan, Africa, and America will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us some inspirational stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Why the United States of Africa is emerging, where human rights campaigns are winning, and how kids kidnapped to ride camels in the Middle East are being returned to their homes. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Richard Mirren, a human rights lawyer whose cases challenge governments and countries across Africa. He's just been in South Africa preparing test cases for 10 gold mine workers. They're all black and all dying of diseases contracted through their work, a potent combination of silicosis combined with tuberculosis. What happened, Richard?
Well, it's a long story and a tragic one. The gold mining industry over the past 100 years has decimated a very large number of black mine workers who've been employed underground, largely, in the most hazardous of conditions, with very little protection. Now, these are hazards that have been known of for 100 years, but the industry obviously was focused on making a profit. As a result of this, there are literally tens of thousands of South African miners who've developed debilitating conditions. Most of them go uncompensated, often untreated as well. You're dealing with a disease, silicosis, which is caused by inhalation of dust, which is incurable. But as you mentioned, in a place where TB is endemic, the problem that exposure to silica dust and silicosis causes is an increased risk of contracting TB as well. And when you've got that combination, the consequences can be fatal.
So who's responsible, and what are you looking for out of this test case?
Well, our test cases are against Anglo American, which is the largest gold mining company in South Africa. In total, at any one time, the industry has employed about 250,000 people, and Anglo is one of the largest. What we're looking for
is
two things.
That's huge. 250,000 people in the industry across Africa?
That's the current in South Africa.
In just South Africa alone?
That's the current level. In the past, it's been higher. It's been up to 400,000 or 500,000. But the industry has contracted in recent years.
This has the sense of disposable people, that people are being asked to work in mines and mortgage their bodies in the process. What kind of rate are we looking at of people who are suffering from these kinds of conditions?
Well, current estimates are in the region of 20 to 25% of the workforce went down with silicosis. Now, that wasn't unexpected on the part of the industry, because, in fact, I found out from a very senior government engineer a couple of years ago that the dust limits that were set on the mines were calculated on the assumption that 15% of the mine workers would contract silicosis if they worked on the mines for 20 years or more.
That's outrageous.
Well, it is outrageous. And when I asked him whether he thought that was an acceptable level, he said he thought it was. Now, I don't think for one minute that if the mine workers had been mainly white workers, that anyone would have regarded that as acceptable. The other thing he told me, which was gobsmacking, really, was when I was asking him about health and safety systems on the mines, we got to talking about showers and change room facilities. Obviously, if you're working in a dusty environment, then having a shower and a change room to change your overalls is vital. And his initial response to me was that there were on-site facilities and using showers was strictly enforced. And then, as an afterthought, he said to me that they didn't have showering facilities in the hostels. And I said, well, that doesn't matter if you had them on site from a health and safety perspective. And then he said, but the on-site facilities were not for black workers. And that didn't change until the mid-1980s. When I asked him whether he thought that was acceptable, he said that obviously I didn't understand because I wasn't from South Africa. Black workers, it wasn't in their culture to have showers. And I said, well, this is a health and safety issue. I mean, even if what you were saying was true, which I don't believe for one moment, but it's a health and safety issue. Weren't you worried about the health and safety of black workers?
Mm.
I was shown the door then. But,
and this is a mining engineer with...
This is a senior government mining engineer, the person who was primarily responsible for overseeing safety in the industry.
Mm. So this is actually an ombudsman-like person who is supposed to be securing the safety of people on behalf of the public interest.
Yes. Of course, you have to bear in mind that this was during the days of apartheid.
Mm.
That was... just par for the course at that time.
I'm wondering what personal effect this has on the workers and their families. Can you give me perhaps one personal story of one of your clients at the moment?
Well, you know, the workers generally have difficulty finding employment at the best of times when they're healthy. When they're not fit, it's even more difficult. And often workers will be providing for a very large family, extended family, wives and children and other relatives. It is absolutely devastating financially when a worker contracts one of these illnesses. But of course, physically, it is even more so. You're dealing with a situation where people have minimal access to state benefits, very poor medical facilities, people who live in rural areas where medical facilities may be non-existent or rudimentary at best, and no means of providing for their families. And if they contract silicosis and then TB, and this is not treated, which is often the case, then the consequences can be fatal, and often are fatal.
What are you looking for on behalf of your clients? What would you like to see happen now?
There are two things, actually. The first, obviously, is compensation, so that they can at least make some provision for their families and themselves. But the second aspect, which I think is something quite novel, is some means of ensuring that their health is monitored. What we're hoping for ultimately is the establishment of a proper medical monitoring scheme. If I can just explain, I mentioned that workers who have silicosis or are exposed to a lot of dust have an increased risk of contracting TB. And TB is obviously something which needs to be detected quickly, and if it is, it can be treated effectively. Now, what happens with these illnesses is, like silicosis, is they do not arise immediately. Often there may be a 10 or 20 year or even more latency period between exposure to dust and contraction of the disease. So frequently, in fact, probably in the majority of cases, mine workers have left the mines and gone back to their homes, to their communities, when they contract these conditions. Now, whilst they're on the mines, there are medical facilities to treat them. But once they've left the mines, no provision is made by the mining industry for their ongoing health care, even though their health has been put at risk because of their work.
And you say they should be.
We say they should be. The mining industry says that it should be able to wash its hands of their medical treatment and monitoring, even though they're responsible for putting their health and safety at risk.
And the numbers involved, I can imagine it would be a very substantial cost and an escalating one as well.
Well, there are tens of thousands of people who could benefit from proper medical monitoring. You know, if people are diagnosed quickly and treated quickly, they can be cured.
And what's the response so far from the company?
As far as medical monitoring is concerned, the company claims that there is no legal basis for a claim. More recently, what we've heard is that they are looking at the possibility of improving health facilities for former mine workers in rural areas. We think that's probably in response to the claim that we've brought. But in any event, if they are doing that, that's progress. But they're not doing it fast enough. This is something they have known about for 50 years.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Australia with international human rights advocate Richard Mirren. Richard's a lawyer who's running test cases in Africa at the moment for gold mining workers whose bosses have allegedly completely neglected their health for profit. Richard, do you think that these cases and attitudes will subside as more and more Africans become involved in mining ventures?
In South Africa, I think there are two reasons why they should hopefully subside. One is, as you point out, because more African people are getting involved in the ventures, and at the moment that particularly includes people who were involved in the struggle, senior ANC people and former activists. But perhaps more importantly in the long term in South Africa is that they have probably the most progressive constitution in the world, and so that provides a protective mechanism for people whose rights are violated by the state or by corporations as well.
Now let's dive into a very interesting debate taking place in Africa at the moment. We all know of the power of the United States of America. So what would happen if the nations of Africa united? An African Union was formed in 2001, and the heads of states and governments in that union have decided to move towards a United States of Africa by 2015. A leading supporter of this initiative is Demba Moussa Dembélé from the African Forum on Alternatives based in Senegal. How do you think that an Africa united will have more control over its resources, Demba?
Yes, I think African unity has always been a dream of any African who cares about the future of the continent. President Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, and other leaders of his time advocated a United States of Africa. But unfortunately, many leaders at the time did not follow him because they wanted to have their own governments, their own presidents, and so on. So Africa remained divided. And if you have small countries divided along borders set by colonial powers, so you will have weak states that cannot defend themselves. And that's what happened to Africa. So the idea of uniting Africa has always been there. It's because now I think African leaders themselves have come to the conclusion that when you have very strong nations like Europe or United States and other countries in North America coming together, or in Asia-Pacific coming together, so the only option remaining for Africa to face these challenges is to come together. Mm. So this is a very good development for us. But as things stand now, I am very pessimistic about having a United States and Africa that can defend itself and its resources.
I'm thinking that one of the reasons why it will be difficult to unite Africa is that nations and states and governments will have to start thinking more of themselves about what they have in common rather than what they have as different from one another. How is debate in Africa resolving those kinds of issues at the moment, or can it?
Yes, you know, I think one of the big challenges here, it's the nature of our leadership. That leadership, I mean, some of them at least, consider still their relationships with the West as more important than their relationships with the rest of Africa, especially the so-called French-speaking Africa. They are more interested in their relationships with France than in their relationships with their neighbors. Mm. For instance, in West Africa, we have the ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, which has been around for 30 years now because it was formed in 1975. But the exchange, the trade between these countries is about 12-15% at the most. But when you take Senegal, for instance, its trade with France is almost 40-50%, which means that unless we change this, that the African leadership looks inward, giving priority to inter-African relationships, we cannot really have a good framework for the unity of Africa. So the leadership is the key, a framework and the vision that takes into account the wishes of the African people.
Indeed. And I'm wondering how that's panning out, because you would actually have to get into place a selection process or a pool of people, wouldn't you? And actually start, training is probably the wrong word, but actually sensitising them to the issues that face Africans across Africa and not just in one region.
Yes, we have been doing it. The African Social Forum had organised a number of activities in which representatives of the African Union took part. And we discussed the trade issues, we discussed conflicts in Africa, we discussed the issues of democracy, of human rights, of citizen participation. We discussed the unity of Africa, how it should be done. So all these issues are being discussed, debated almost daily with African heads of state, African prime ministers, or with regional economic commissions. So it's almost a permanent dialogue. Some of the leaders are listening, but others are not listening at all.
I suppose a big question about whether or not this is going to succeed is what the reaction of the rest of the world will be to it, Demba. And I'm thinking about prime influences such as the United States, you've mentioned France, and China, that rising superpower within Africa at the moment. What feedback are you getting from civil society in those countries, but also those countries themselves?
Civil societies in those countries, at least as far as I know from the United States, from France or other European countries, these civil society organizations are working with us. They share our basic concerns about the relationships that exist between Africa and their countries. For instance, with the European Union, we have a big issue that is being discussed at the Economic Partnership Agreements. And the Economic Partnership Agreements are just a free trade agreement that the European Union wants to impose on Africa. And we are fighting it. And the most civil society organizations in Europe are with us. With the United States, most organizations in the United States work with us on the issues of security, on the issues of human rights, on the issues of debt, on the issues of trade. And they are in Washington, in New York, or elsewhere, also trying to raise awareness about what Bush government is trying to do in Africa to divert resources away from development to security or military issues.
And what do you expect from the governments in the United States and from China? Do you expect them to support a united Africa? One of the things that you were saying earlier in the program was that a united Africa could actually help Africans defend themselves. And that's double-pronged, isn't it? We're not just talking militarily here, we're also talking economically.
Yes. On paper, they support the United States of Africa. They say they support it. But in reality, as you know, they are not really enthusiastic about it because they feel that really united Africa will be able to defend itself, to control its own resources, and to formulate its own development policies.
Yes.
This is not in the interest of global imperialism. And these countries, Europe and the United States in particular, their objective is to continue to dominate Africa, is to continue to control Africa's resources. So they say they support it, but they will do anything they can to undermine the United States of Africa. And we know that. And some African leaders are aware of that. Africa must count on itself. Others will say, okay, we support you, but we know in the end it is against their fundamental interests.
Yes. Demba, I'd like to introduce human rights advocate Richard Meeran into this conversation now. Richard, as someone who has an intimate connection with South Africa, do you see benefits in a United States of Africa for improving human rights?
You know, I hadn't really considered it before, Chris, but I can see the logic in what Demba is saying, that as a combined force, a United States may be able to reduce the level of exploitation, especially of the weaker countries in Africa. That combined force may include, for instance, harmonisation of certain laws that would protect, for instance, the rights of workers or environmental rights.
Demba, how would it work? Would there be common laws across Africa or common leadership across Africa, or would it be all states are governing themselves but on some central issues to Africa they would unite and pass responsibility for legislation and policy over to a central leadership?
According to the document that's being circulated and discussed, they would move towards a federal state where the states themselves can have some kind of autonomy. But there are some basic policies that will be coordinated at the federal level. Basically, what they are talking about is a federal state where we'll have one army, a continental army, that's able to defend Africa, a president that's also elected for all the continent, with, of course, states probably like what's happening in the United States, something like that. So that's the framework.
I'm thinking that there will be a number of governments who would resist a move like that. The countries that immediately spring to mind are Sudan, Ethiopia, Congo, Somalia. And I suppose that that brings up the second thing that I'm wondering about with this whole idea, which is how do you actually police, for instance, human rights abuses in countries when you have a United States, unless Africans are prepared to prosecute, to actually make accountable other Africans?
Yeah, the issue of human rights must be at the center of this United States of Africa. If the different civil society organizations across the continent have their voice in this process, I think the issue of human rights will be one of the fundamental issues in the constitution of this United States of Africa, because you cannot have a viable United States of Africa without respecting the fundamental human rights of African citizens, without calling to account those leaders who violate human rights. So it's a fundamental. Otherwise, it won't be viable at all.
Demba Moussa Dembélé, thank you for joining us today. Demba Moussa Dembélé is from the African Forum on Alternatives, based in Senegal. If you'd like to read more from Demba, he's written a very good article for that wonderful online news forum promoting social justice in Africa, Pan Bazooka, which is at www.panbazooka.org. Thanks very much, Demba. Great to speak to you. Good luck with all the work you're doing now. It sounds fantastic.
Thank you, Chris. It was nice talking to you. Nice also talking to Richard about these issues of human rights.
Interesting development, Richard.
Very interesting discussion. I was just thinking at the end of it, though, that the fact that it might not be possible to go all the way and include all African states in some kind of United States arrangement wouldn't prevent you from going part of the way. For instance, by forming a slightly less tight alliance between some African states who are prepared to participate in that.
That's a very interesting point.
Something like, I suppose, the next level down from the United States of America is the European Union, which is not quite a federation yet.
But also brings in states regularly, doesn't it?
Brings in states, doesn't include them all, but is a very potent force.
I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast by alternative media sources around the world, like the one you're listening to now. Let's go now from Africa to Pakistan to hear about the fate of child jockeys. Children, some as young as four, have been kidnapped, bought or conscripted into a number of Middle Eastern countries where they're regarded as prized assets in camel races. They're light, and their frightened screams when they're tied onto the camels make the camels move more quickly when they race. Zubair Shahd is a director of the Child Protection and Welfare Bureau in Lahore in Pakistan, and he's helping to repatriate young Pakistanis who've been child jockeys in the United Arab Emirates. Tell us how these children came to be child jockeys, Zubair.
There are so many factors, some of the push factors and some of the pull factors. You may say that in push factors, we have poverty, lack of educational opportunities, then we have the poor parental supervision, then poor law enforcement and lack of awareness. These are the some of the push factors who forces parents, guardians, communities to send the children to the other countries. The main reason is the poverty, poor parental supervision and lack of awareness regarding what can happen with their children during the camel races by living there, what kind of possible problem their child may face during these races.
And what's your role in bringing them home?
UNICEF and UAE government have an agreement for the repatriation or safe return of all those children who are previously involved in the camel races. And UAE government posed a ban on the camel races in the 2005 April. That was a presidential order. And then children from the different countries like Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sudan and others are to be repatriated in their respective countries with the help of social support center established by the UAE authorities and others. And in Pakistan, we have received almost 650 children from those countries.
Mm. This is not a problem that's limited to the UAE, although that's where I understand most of these children have been repatriated from. I'm very interested to learn how the UAE came to sign this presidential agreement. Was it that there were conventions internationally in place, or was some pressure placed on the UAE to do this? How did it...
That might be the pressure. UNICEF and other countries and human rights activists might have raised certain opposition for using children as a camel jockeys.
And there was an international outcry in media that I was reading about.
Of course it seems to be. And in Pakistan, we are also facing a lot of problem when we realize any harm could happen with their children right now in the camel races. Anything could happen with the children. They might be facing any kind of injury because when a children is sitting on the camel, he may fall down.
Mm.
He might be lost.
As I understand it, one way in which the United Arab Emirates is dealing with the problem is to substitute children for robots now. And
yes, they are using right now robot.
I'm wondering about other Middle Eastern countries that might not be as wealthy but still have...
We are trying to probe into the matter right now, and we have made a request to the UNICEF authorities to probe and watch in other countries. Perhaps the camel races are still ongoing, but what we have heard that in other countries also, they are planning or they have planned to impose the ban on the camel races.
Mm, very interesting. That was Zubair Shard, who is one of the directors of the Child Protection and Welfare Bureau in Lahore in Pakistan. Zubair, good luck in your repatriation efforts.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'd like to bring human rights lawyer Richard Mirren into our conversation now. Richard, I'm wondering, what's the use of international conventions for the protection of children when thousands end up like this as child jockeys in the Middle East?
Well, exactly. I mean, there are international conventions. There are conventions against torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, which may well apply to this situation. There is the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Two issues. One is whether they've signed up to the convention, and the other issue is whether they have then translated that signing up to the convention into their own domestic law. For instance, Australia is a signatory to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but hasn't incorporated that convention into its domestic law.
Richard, I'm just wondering what the cultural value of some of these conventions might be that even if a country hasn't signed up for one, it strikes me that people could still use those conventions as international standards of acceptable behaviour and get some results with them, irrespective of whether or not a country signed. Has that been your experience, or is that just some wishful thinking on my behalf?
Oh, I'm sure politically what you're saying is correct, even though they may not be directly enforceable, either internationally or under their own domestic law. The other convention to mention with regard to the child jockeys is the Torture Convention, which countries are much more likely to have signed up to. So that I would have thought based on what we've heard, that there must be a good argument in some of these cases that these children have been subjected to inhuman and degrading treatment.
Mm, indeed. Richard Murren, you're a true internationalist. Your mother's an Indian. You have intimate connections with South Africa. As I understand it, you were raised in South Africa, were you?
Oh, no, my father is from South Africa.
Ah, your father is from South Africa.
And most of my family are in South Africa, but I was actually born in Stockwell in London.
Indeed. And now you work with law firms in England and Australia. And you've had a very direct experience with the vulnerability of children. I understand that you returned with your mother to India recently to revisit her childhood. Tell us what you and your family were looking for there.
Well, as a child, I'd heard lots of stories from my mother about her having grown up in a school in a place called Kalimpong, which is near Darjeeling in the northeast of India. It's actually the place where the most recent Booker Prize book, which is called Inheritance of Loss, was set. And, in fact, it mentions the school that she went to.
Which was? What was the name of the
which
school?
Which is called Dr. Graham's Homes, and it was a school that was actually established over 100 years ago for Anglo-Indian children who had been abandoned. This was the result, obviously, of an influx of British men who worked on the railways and in the services, who had children with local women and then abandoned them. So this is why this school was set up. It was a Presbyterian Church of Scotland school. And so my mother went there when she was 3 years old, and she lived there until she was 18. And it was quite an interesting school, an interesting area, because the Anglo-Indian children who went to this school were impoverished children, but they were subsidized by wealthy Indian children who came from neighboring states, because the people in that state, who are mainly Nepalese and Tibetan, wouldn't have been able to afford to go to that school. So you've got this school, which is in quite extensive grounds, which comprised a mixture of very poor Anglo-Indian children and wealthy Indian children in an area which was mainly very poor Nepalese and Tibetan people. And of course, in recent years, it has been the focus of a lot of uprising and struggle.
So a very difficult situation for your mother as a child, virtually abandoned by her father at birth, and then her mother...
Her mother died. Her mother died when she was three.
Right.
Which was why she was then taken into the school. But she found that in the school there were three boys who, it turned out, were her half-brothers from the same father, but with a different mother.
Right.
She didn't know them, and she never knew them, but when we went to the school in January, we found out quite a bit about her and about them from the school records. So it was a very emotional experience.
I can imagine. And you were with your family at the time, so your children were there as well.
Yes.
And they were finding out about their grandmother, as your grandmother was finding out too about her life as a child.
Her recollection was remarkably vivid, actually. I mean, she even remembered the cupboard that she used to put her clothes in, which still had some of her graffiti on it that we saw. We saw the swimming pool that she used to sometimes go to with her friends in the middle of the night. They weren't allowed to do that, but we also climbed over the wall of the swimming pool just as part of the experience. It was quite an incredible place.
And your mother would have been, had she not been in this school, one of the many street children in India. This seems to be a refuge that was offered to your mother. Was it solely because of the colour of her skin, the fact that she had a British father?
Yes, I mean, I think that... I mean,
it
is,
saved
it
her
is,
life.
It did, and it's... It's a strange, I suppose, contradiction, the idea that there would be a refuge just for Anglo-Indian children when there were obviously so many poor Indian children who would have benefited from a refuge as well. When she was 18, she was sent to England by the school because I think one of the reasons was they didn't want their Anglo-Indian children to be marrying Indian men and women. So she was sent to England, probably in the hope that she would marry someone English, and then she hitched up with my father.
Who was from South Africa.
Who's Indian from South Africa.
And from your mother's point of view, it must have been a great education as well. I'm wondering whether or not it was a British education or an Indian education or a combination of educations.
Oh, it's very British. although I hadn't realized this until we went there this year, that she actually speaks quite a lot of Hindi. I was completely unaware of that, but I heard her speaking to people in Hindi.
So this must have been a voyage of discovery about you as well, about your connection with India and your children's connection to India through their grandmother.
Oh, absolutely, and it was such an important experience for us to have. It really was a question of finding our roots, and we really felt some affinity with that part of India while we were there and since then.
I'm wondering what it feels like to be part of a country that you actually have come from, to go back to India when you've got a parent who's from South Africa. Where do you call home? Do you call the world your home, or do you call a specific country your home? You grew up in England.
Oh, look, I'm very confused as far as the place I call home. I think the basis of the affinity that I feel with each of these places is different. In the case of India, I suppose it's because I know that's where my origins are on both sides of my family, and because I look Indian. In the case of South Africa, it's a very deep connection which goes back to my family and lots of trips that I made as a child to South Africa, and the strength of feeling that I have about the history of South Africa. And in the case of England, well, I grew up there and I was born there.
Richard, our next guest will be talking about the power of non-violence in bringing about change. Change of governments, change of policy, change of attitudes. You've chosen law as a way of bringing about change. How effective is it as a tool compared to, say, other ways in your life that you've taken up and found very useful?
My experience of the cases that we've dealt with over the last 15 years shows that the law can certainly be a very powerful weapon. For instance, in holding corporations accountable. You know, if you hit a company where it hurts, namely in the pocket, it'll soon mend its ways. But I've also encountered some quite uplifting personal examples of the way in which involvement in these issues and legal cases can affect people's lives. There was one particularly striking example which involved an assistant who came to work with me about 15 years ago on my South African cases. She was actually South African, and she was a white South African, and she came from quite a privileged background. And after a while, I began to realize that her attitudes were not the kind that we really wanted in our office at all. I mean, she was very racist and prejudiced. And what happened was that as she began to find out about the cases, what had happened to the workers who we were acting for, her attitude began to change. Because she was beginning to see things that hadn't really confronted her in the past. She was getting involved in arguments with her boyfriend's father, and he owned a factory and was very antagonistic towards any case which was brought against an employer, let alone on behalf of black workers. And then what happened a couple of years down the line was that a student came to work in our office who was from Mexico. He was the kind of guy who she would never have had any interest in at all. She took off with him. Her parents disowned her, and they got married. And some while after that, she wrote a letter to a journalist who'd written a book about the misconduct of mining companies in South Africa. And she told him in the book how working on our cases had opened up all kinds of possibilities that had never been available to her before and had really opened her eyes. And she said that she was working with an AIDS charity. This is a woman who I remember had said that people who had AIDS deserved it. I mean, that was the attitude that she'd come in with. So for me, that was a really kind of uplifting story, you know. It was,
and something very basic too, isn't it? It's about education, it's about knowledge, it's actually about opening up people's horizons so that they can see clearly.
I'm sure she's not the only one who thinks like that, but who has an open mind, and if given the opportunity could change their attitude as well.
And it's a great platform for our next guest to join our program, because our next guest is from an organisation called Training for Change. Richard Meeran, unfortunately, I know that you have to go now. Thank you so much for being co-host with me tonight on our program. It's been a delight having you. Hope you'll join us again in the not too distant future.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and we've been chatting with a range of guests today from Africa, Pakistan, and now the United States. Daniel Hunter has just called in from Philadelphia, where he's a training associate with Training for Change, an extraordinary organisation working mainly in the Global South, training progressive people to bring about major social changes in their countries in a non-violent way. Everything from helping AIDS activists protect their communities to developing strategies that will overthrow dictators. Daniel, how powerful a tool for change do you think education is as compared to something like armed resistance? Just a small question.
Well, I mean, I think education is really the basis of taking action. And I'm a big believer in democracy, and I think democracy requires participation, representation, and education. And so I think creating a kind of education that's consistent with democratic beliefs is one of the pillars of creating a democratic society. Empowerment is about assisting people to take advantage of what they already know and to use that to manifest their goals by using whatever life experience they've had, their successes and failures, because people have experience of the political realm. People know what's going on. I'm reminded actually a bit of my neighbor growing up. I grew up on farm territory, and my neighbor was a dairy farmer who could break down Reaganomics all the way from global economics down to how it affected the price of what you would get for milk. And I think that's the kind of analysis and understanding that we're looking for when we do training work. So one of the things that I'll be doing in a couple of weeks is headed to Germany to do training with G8 activists. When I do a training around, for example, the question of armed struggle versus other struggles, I'm encouraging people to think about what are the values that they're operating on. Because what I often find is that as activists, we bring our own baggage to our own thinking. And if we're going to have a strategic conversation, it means that we need to understand our own background of where we're coming from in order to figure out where we think we should go. My experience in the States is that a lot of the desire for violence comes out of a sense of powerlessness, a sense of mounting frustration that's left people feeling optionless and feeling like, therefore, we must become more extreme and therefore engage in acts of violence. And my experience is that that doesn't resonate with lots of people in the U.S. So the violence that happened in Seattle continues to turn off many people. So in much of my work, I've been working in a lot of working class neighborhoods in Philadelphia. We were talking about a media strategy, and they said, whatever we do, we can't become those activists from like the World Trade Organization, like those people who just smash stuff. This group actually is a series of people who are very concerned that we don't get framed in that way. Because they said, if we get framed that way, no one will listen to us and no one will take us seriously. These are very sharp activists coming out of Philadelphia and represented a number of neighborhoods. So one of the questions I often ask people who are interested in violence is, what's your goal? If your goal is to resonate with people, it's not succeeding. If your goal is to be extreme and to be engaged in what I call the politics of personal expression, which is to express yourself, then you may in fact be being successful. But the politics of personal expression isn't the same thing as building a movement. And because my fundamental interest is in building a movement, I am most interested in assisting people in how do you plan on winning. So a similar thing can also be pushed on with so-called pacifists. A lot of pacifists, I think, have given up pushing the envelope of tactics. That is, doing a tactic that isn't socially acceptable. And my personal belief is that nonviolent action is all about pushing the envelope. And that's why it's dramatic, and that's why you get a reaction. So for many pacifists, I think they've given up that and have engaged in a routineness. There's a group that I'm familiar with, which every couple of weeks does a direct action, gets arrested, gets out of jail, and then does it again. What they're calling direct action, I think, is called a script. And it becomes very ritualistic. I think many of our marches actually have become very ritualistic.
And people turn off. And it's like crying wolf, isn't it? That if you do it enough, people stop hearing.
That's right. Violent activists have assumed that they're not engaged in rituals anymore. But actually, my experience is that the movement that we've seen of VA and the sort of series of actions that we've seen around that have become fairly ritualistic. And even though our content that we may bring or the signs that we happen to have may be telling one thing, the real framing isn't what we say, it's what we do. This movement that I've been working on right now has been a movement around casinos in Philadelphia, and we've been trying to stop two casinos from coming in. This is the first time they're ever trying to build two casinos in a major residential city, so Philadelphia being the largest city that would ever host casinos in the state. And they're 24/7 free unlimited drinks, six liquor licenses, and built 100 feet from people's homes.
Wow.
You know, you ask any developer, any planning person, it's a bad idea. We've been engaged in a whole wide spectrum of strategies that all sort of congeal, and of course, lots of direct action. And we've been engaged in several civil disobedience actions. We did one a couple months ago where we had 14 people who were arrested, only two of whom had ever been arrested before in their life for any kind of civil disobedience, at least. The differences of strategies that all have an overlapping value, the value that we're most circulating around again and again is a value on transparency, because we're very much pushing for a transparent government. We think the opposite of corruption is transparency. Transparency is the number one theme, so we're operating in a way that shows that we have nothing to hide. Let me just give an example of a way that we framed the debate. As I've been mentioning, we were very much in value of transparency. The Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, which is this body that made this decision to put a casino right next to people's homes, in the lead-up to this decision, they engaged in a very fake and non-transparent process where they were deciding where casinos should be built and saying that they would have public input. So they had 2 days of public hearings where the public was allowed to speak for 2 minutes. It was during the daytime, so people would have to take off work to be there. And after those 2 days of public input, that was it. The public had no poor input. So they continued to have what they called public hearings, but the public wasn't allowed to speak at them. And they further engaged in allowing the casino operators to change their plans. So we had given input on plans as we understood them. And then the casino operators were allowed to change their plans. One casino operator added 2 acres to their site. Another casino operator changed their plans 46 times. So they were engaged in, I think, a very dirty process where the public was being locked out. Well, we said a very shared value is the public's right to know. So we decided to engage in this campaign called Operation Transparency, where we made our claim that we should have access to the information, such as site plans, traffic plans, revenue projections, and that if we weren't allowed to be given this information, we would have to go take it ourselves. And we'd do so in what we called a citizen search and seizure. Sometimes we called it a citizen's document search, which, to our knowledge, is the first one that was done in the States. We actually were inspired by some Canadian activists who did this. The idea was we'd make a demand that's very reasonable. I mean, most of the public actually would take our side on that. And then we would say, well, we'll give you a chance to do the right thing. So we gave them about a month and a half to do the right thing. And we did various actions along the way. We, for example, went to their offices and we washed their windows to become more transparent. And engaged in, you know, small creative actions. We're a very small group, only 10, 15 people. During that time, we're able to get some media people who had been very hostile to us. and were able to get some media coverage on some of the small actions. You know, they were, of course, you know, calling us, you know, crazies and, you know, ridiculous people and so forth. But at least they were covering us. And we did have this interesting demand, which is we said, if they don't make the doctrines public, we'll go to the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board's offices and we'll attempt to take them ourselves, which was a very interesting and compelling message to people. So the day of our ultimatum passed and the doctrines hadn't been made public, so we did a series of trainings to prepare people for this action. And 14 of us, backed by about 80, 90 people, went down to the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board offices and held a rally and then moved the rally to the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board offices and attempted the citizen's document search. We did it by two of us at a time would go up to the security desk there and read a citizen search warrant, which explained the public has a right to know, you know, very much framing ourselves within the mainstream, the context of the mainstream value about the public's right to know, the public's right to quality information. Then we proceeded to go on up to the Pennsylvania Game Control Board offices and try to search for them. Well, the police were there, and the police did, in fact, arrest all 14 of us who attempted this. And the huge public outcry resulted as people saw 14 people who were acting very citizenly. And in fact, we were, of course, charged. And the judge threw out the case very strongly, in the most strongly wording I've ever seen a judge do, because he said they were simply doing their citizen right and their citizen's duty. And he said, what do you guys have to hide? Which, of course, was our point all along.
Mm.
And so I think what that action demonstrated in large part was it's on us to frame the debate based on our actions. And we could have said many, many things. In fact, we tried to get them to do corruption stories, and we tried to get reporters to understand the level of insider politics, and there are so many pieces of how ugly this was. But we needed to use our actions to very carefully frame in a way that would assist more and more people to come onto our side. And when people heard about the Pennsylvania Game Control Board's lack of transparency, many more people came onto our side, and we were able to win allies over, which increased our movement. So we moved from being a group of 10, 15 people to, by the end of it, a couple hundred.
Wow. And
within a couple months later.
Amazing results.
Right. And another theme is democratic process, by which I think we particularly mean any decision that affects people, they should have input on.
Mm.
And so we're both modeling ourselves internally in a democratic way. People understand our values less by what we say and much more by what we do.
Mm.
So, for example, if we said that we believe in transparency, but we acted in a way that showed that we had things to hide, people would very quickly write us off.
Yes.
And I think with a lot of good reasoning, we are the ones who really need to model for people how democracy and values of openness and good government and other pieces that we believe, how those things should take place. So if we believe in a government that should be open, we need to model the kind of openness that we're looking for. And I think that's one reason why, for example, in this campaign, which has been very working class inspired campaign, there hasn't been any conversation about violence.
Mm.
And I think because in order to take up violence in this campaign, we would have to gauge in acts of secrecy. And there wouldn't be an effective way for us to smash things, for example, without becoming closed.
That was Daniel Hunter, Training Associate for Training for Change. Daniel, look, thank you so much for joining our conversation today. It's been fascinating hearing your stories.
Thanks much, Chris. It's been great. Bye.
Bye. Okay, well, that's it from today's Radio New Internationalist. Join us same time, same place on the dial next week for our mobile phone special. Thanks, as always, to this program's assistant producer, Rachel Ma. Thanks, Rach. And thanks, too, to tonight's co-host, international human rights lawyer Richard Mirren, who shared with us some fascinating stories. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Introducing Shiani Nkobo, who captures the Zulu sound and poetry of Maskandi. Shiani started his musical career when he begged his brother to show him how to make his first igogo, which is a guitar made from a 5-litre oil can. You'll find his work and an exciting range of other majority world artists on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. You'll also find copies of this program on the New Internationalist website, just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. I'm Chris Richards. Let's speak again soon.